Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, as you so well put it in the Morning Jolt today, you'd think that the booing was the only thing that happened during the Mitt Romney speech at the NAACP convention down in Houston on Wednesday. And that certainly was part of what happened down there, of course. But the headline, I think the good martini today, is a couple of things on a number of fronts. First of all, Romney's the only presidential candidate that's actually attending the NAACP convention. Obama either thinks he's got him in the bag or he doesn't want to have to answer to a 14.4% unemployment rate among black Americans. Nonetheless, what I think the best thing for Mitt Romney is that he actually talked about what he believed. He knew it would be unpopular, and he stuck with it. Here's the most popular part of the exchange, but probably the part that the mainstream media didn't play as much as we're going to play right here about how Romney responded to the booze.
And so to do that, I'm going to eliminate every non-essential, expensive program I can find. That includes Obamacare, and I'm going to work to reform and save. There was a survey of the Chamber of Commerce. They carried out a survey of their members, about 1,500 surveyed. And they asked them what effect that Obamacare would have on their plans. And three-quarters of them said that made them less likely to hire people. So I say again, if our priority is jobs, and that's my priority, that's something I'd change.
Good for Romney to stick to his guns there, Jim. It helps to rub away the flip-flopper image that he had unfortunately developed over the years. And he did talk about 14.4% unemployment among black Americans, something that one of the NAACP officials said was insensitive for some reason. Romney basically telling black Americans, like he's telling everybody in America, if you want things to improve, vote for me. Good for him. It's not an easy crowd to talk to, obviously. Most of them won't vote for him, but he's showing the rest of the country that he's willing to engage anyone.
Putting booze in the headline is kind of disingenuous, because if you watch the whole thing, it was a fairly warm reception, or at the very least a cordial and polite reception. You just play the audio. I was stunned this morning to see on the front page of the Washington Post, Romney appeared unsettled by three. Did that sound unsettled to you, Greg?
No,
I mean, that, you know,
he just patiently waited.
It's one of those things. Look, this was a circumstance which any Republican candidate going to visit the NAACP, by most standards, a very liberal organization, is probably going to find, you know, a tough reception. And when you run against the reelection campaign of the first African American president, you're going to have an even tougher time. And so here comes in Romney, you know, and I thought it was one of his best speeches of his campaign. Maybe he was liberated by the fact that he kind of knew that there was almost no way he could persuade anybody in that room to vote for him. And so he, you know, could just let the chips fall where they may, say what they want. I don't think that the booing was excessive or terrible or anything. And all of the criticism, you know, a lot of the whining about Romney's appearance we've seen from the folks on the left, I think this really was the best scenario that could come out of this for him. Because if he skipped it, well, we know what people would be saying about that. I don't think there's any point in really trying to argue with the audience or to get, you know, he laid out his argument of why he thought Obamacare was a job killer. And then he moved on to other topics, and I think that was fine. Well, Obamacare remains pretty darn unpopular, including new numbers out from Quinnipiac this morning. So basically he says, I'm going to repeal an unpopular bill, and the crowd boos him, and he doesn't back down. I don't think that's really that bad an outcome for him at all. I think, if anything, the public might think less of the NAACP as a result of that exchange. So NAACP was, I'd say, largely cordial in their response to him. Apparently, the informal survey of members afterwards was that almost nobody was going to vote for him, but everybody was glad he came and, you know, felt like he'd kind of won over some respect. And I think a lot of voters who still have this sense of tired of the partisanship, tired of the nastiness in politics, will look at Romney's behavior yesterday and say it was classy, it was respectful, it was reaching out to people who are unlikely to agree with him, but still treating them with respect. The most unexpected aspect of yesterday for me, Greg, was watching Wolf Blitzer just tear into Barack Obama for not addressing the NAACP and basically taking the organization and that demographic for granted. I don't know if that itself is going to move any votes, but it just kind of seemed that somebody, for what it's worth, CNN's main anchor, thought that Romney completely played yesterday correctly and that Obama completely botched it.
On to martini number two now. Jim, and you and I were young, impressionable teenagers when Marion Barry was mayor of Washington, D.C., and got caught smoking crack on tape, went to prison, came back, somehow got elected mayor again, and Washington, D.C. became a laughingstock for its leadership. Well, Mayor Vincent Gray has not been caught smoking crack on tape with an undercover informant. However, he is being pressured to resign by now three members of the city council for essentially his campaign running a shadow campaign during his run for mayor back in 2010 when he took out Adrian Fenty. $600,000 went towards this shadow campaign. The Gray campaign only raised $1.2 million for its own efforts, so that'd be something that's pretty hard to ignore. There's now evidence that Gray knew about it at least shortly after the race was over, probably knew about it before. And for a city that's desperately wanting to get itself out from the thumb of the federal government and restore some credibility, it's not getting anywhere.
Kind of a little bit of background is worthwhile for listeners to Three Martini Lunch. So keep in mind, you know, Washington, D.C. is, I don't know if it's 90% Democrat, but it's something in that neighborhood. So there is no effective Republican Party. So the contest for where, you know, right of center D.C. residents, which neither you nor I are still there, but I used to live there, is between terrible Democrats and sort of less terrible Democrats. And even sometimes you'll get a pretty good Democrat. I think I'd put Anthony Williams in that category, sure. A former mayor. After Anthony Williams, you had Adrian Fenty, who I think from the eyes of most folks on the right was very much a mixed bag. But if nothing else, Adrian Fenty was committed to serious education reform. And he had a D.C. superintendent of schools who had no problem antagonizing the teachers' unions and who completely rejected the notion that all we needed was more money and pointed out that D.C. schools probably spent more per student than anybody else in the country and ended up getting worse results. And this became a very big part of the last D.C. mayoral Democratic primary. And Vincent Gray was the non-education reform candidate. He was the teachers' union's favorites, and he was basically that Fenty was seen as this rabble-rouser. And Fenty was kind of back to the way things had always been in D.C., which is to say thoroughly crappy. Gray won in a defeat for the forces of reform and all that is good. The name Gray seemed to fit him, that he was the face of the entrenched D.C. political bureaucracy. Well, now it turns out that basically he's got a whole bunch of scandals, including basically a shadow campaign, basically an entire effort to get him elected that he says he had no idea about. It seems exceptionally unlikely. Ties to city contractors, the idea they were financing a rival who was also attacking Adrian Fenty, the idea of, you know, right, running a stalking horse in the campaign. Just every bit as thoroughly corrupt as people had kind of feared and suspected D.C. government was. So Vincent Gray has this really, really inspiring response. Did you happen to catch that, Greg? This is not the campaign we intended to run. Things happened, Patty. I didn't mean to run up to be unbelievably corrupt, you know. I just accidentally had my donors running a shadow campaign on my behalf. One of the D.C. councilmen pointed out, to believe Gray's story, you have to believe these D.C., you know, government contractors spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to ensure Gray's election and then didn't tell him. They wanted to do him a huge favor, but they didn't want him to know that they did him a huge favor, which seems exceptionally unlikely. And he's now offering these lame BS excuses and makes me glad I live in Northern Virginia. And it's depressing because there were signs of D.C. starting to climb up out of the mire and the muck of the Marion Barry years. And it looks like Gray is just going to be an absolute disaster of a mayor. And, you know, all I can say is thank you, D.C. teachers unions, for making sure that the corrupt guy won last time out. Your sterling record continues for another cycle.
On to martini number three now, and let's move to Illinois Democratic Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. He's kind of kept a pretty low profile over the past few years, ever since he was implicated in the Rod Blagojevich Senate seat scandal that erupted after Barack Obama won the presidency. Anyway, he's taken a leave of absence from the House of Representatives now for a good month. And the reasons have just continued to change. First, there was he needed some time off. We're not really sure when he's going to be back. Then there were signs and suggestions that he had attempted suicide, that he was in rehab. Now his office says that he's being treated for a mood disorder that was a little bit more serious than previously thought. And he still won't be back till after Labor Day. Sounds like there's a lot more than is being revealed here, and even Democrats on Capitol Hill are upset that he's not being more forthcoming.
Yeah, there's a couple of weird aspects here. The first is that, could you know, we all remember the infamous story of Mark Sanford going down to Argentina, and his staff thought he was hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Right.
It's kind of weird that a congressman could just drop off the radar screen for 2 weeks and nobody notices. Most of them lead fairly public lives, but the idea that it was like 2 weeks before anybody knows, hey, has anybody seen Jesse Jackson Jr. lately? Kind of seems strange. The initial explanation was that he had stress, And I feel sympathetic to that, Greg, because, you know, as you know, no one else has stress. You know, congressmen have the toughest lives of all. Because it's so vague, there's no explanations. There are some people who fear that he may have a serious physical ailment or a serious mental ailment, or that some other factor may be involved. To avoid any potential libel or slander suits, I'll just let, you know, people use their imaginations. Bottom line being that there are people who think that it's possible Jesse Jackson Jr.'s sudden mysterious absence is due to a serious problem he has. If that's the case, you feel sympathetic to the guy and you wish him a speedy recovery, but he has a job. His job is to represent his constituents, and he hasn't been doing that for quite a few weeks now. And so if it's one thing for a Hollywood star to check into rehab or something, and to, you know, say, chalk it up to exhaustion or something, that's one thing. But look, you have a job to represent your constituents, and if you can't do that, I think at the very least you got to have something more detailed than exhaustion or stress, or now this latest thing, mood disorder. I mean, that makes him sound like he's, you know, he's had a bad day or something, and he needs a s'more or something to pick him up. Hopefully Jesse Jackson Jr. will come out of whatever he's going through okay, but the whole treatment of the public, I think, is not reassuring, and I think it's probably disturbing the arrogance in which he believes that he doesn't owe anyone an explanation to this. There have been rumors that he's been, you know, that he might get named in investigations and indictments and such. So this sudden serious health, you know, mental, physical health issue just happens to be very convenient for him. So we will see what happens, and hopefully things will turn out not too badly for the Democratic congressman. But it is certainly mysterious, certainly weird, and I think it certainly is not a – it suggests an attitude of unaccountability that I think is not good, even by the standards of Chicago politicians.
Yeah, he's the subject of a House Ethics Committee investigation as well, so we'll see if any of this is intertwined. We don't want to jump to conclusions, but we're throwing all the facts on the table. Of course, if he was a Republican, we'd know exactly where he was, because as we mentioned earlier in the week, the Democrats would have stalked him all the way to his location, whether it's a hospital or a treatment center or wherever else it was. So, Jim? Have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
All right. See you later, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And please join us again on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.